One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on George Street in Marylebone, W1. One street south of the first killing by the Blackout Ripper. Two streets east of the failed hit on the exiled Iraqi general. A few doors down from the deaf son's desperate mum. And a few doors up from Dot the Deadly. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Built in the 1930s, Firscroft is a posh 10-story Edwardian mansion block. The kind you'd expect to see in an episode of Poirot. Where for 90 minutes, the infamous Belgian detective twists his little moustache and jiggles his little grey cells, all the while dreaming of waffles, chocolate, Tintin, and Moulay Fritz, as what else do Belgians do? Only to conclude that, dun dun dun, the killer was the slutty bigamist. Again. And yet, Marylebone's own detectives almost failed to solve a simple case owing to an assumption. On the Boxing Day morning of 1948, 50-year-old Harry Michelson was found on his doorstep at flat 75. With a towel to his forehead, blood running down his face, and no memory of what had occurred. With no signs of forced entry, the police assumed they were hunting an assailant who Harry had let in. And although they had supposedly interrogated every detail given by every eyewitness who knew Harry well, it took a sharp-eyed constable with a suspicious nose to truly trap his killer. My name is Michael. I'm your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 233. Sketches. Eugene Fordsworth said, "Assumption is the mother of all mistakes." It's a crime we've all committed, as sometimes it's too easy to assume that the most logical answer must be the right answer. For us, it's a mistake we can make with very little consequences. But for detectives, it can derail an investigation. Harry Saul Michelson was born on the 14th of December 1898. Being raised in a loving, well-educated middle-class family and spending most of his first five decades in and around Willesden and Paddington. Being 5'6" and sparsely built, those who knew Harry described him as a cheery and pleasant gentleman who was always kind. And as a talented cartoonist and an acclaimed commercial artist, he loved to while away his free time by sketching friends and strangers over a cup of tea and a chat. But painting was also how he made his living. Nicknamed One Minute Michelson, Harry toured the theatres of Great Britain as a lightning cartoonist who wowed the crowds with his speedy sketching as part of a musical act. As an immensely creative man who brought joy to the masses, especially as the bombs of the Luftwaffe pummeled every British city while the Second World War raged on, it made perfect sense that Harry would fall in love, possibly on the circuit, with a talented pianist called Anna. In November 1938, they married at Willesden Registry Office. And as performers with no children, it was said that they toured together. But with Harry having contracted malaria during the First World War, and still suffering from the long-term effects of fevers, chills, aches and pains, as well as stomach problems and nerves, described by his younger brother as highly strung. For the sake of his health, he gave up performing and continued working from home with a set of paints and an easel by his bed. In 1941, Harry and Anna moved into a small bed-sitting room flat at Firscroft in Marylebone. As a basement flat, the view from its two casement windows wasn't much, as it overlooked the concrete wall below the corner of Brown Street and Nutford Place. But as a modern block with solid locks and being staffed by a team of porters day and night, what they paid for was the amenities and the security. For Harry, who spent most of his days alone in this tiny two-roomed flat, it had everything he needed. A kitchen-cum-bathroom, with a toilet and a bath in the same room as the gas hob, which was perfectly normal for that era. And a bed-sitting room, with two single beds, a phone, a gas fire, a wealth of artwork, a daybed for resting while he sketched, with an easel, paints, and heaped stacks of magazines and papers for reference, as well as a tubular metal chair where his guests could sit as they posed for his portraits. As a polite but solitary figure, he always greeted the porters. He often went for morning coffee at Maison Lyonnaise, and although a semi-regular guest at Sketch, an artist's members club, not being much of a drinker owing to gastric issues, he spent most of his time alone in his flat, painting. He wasn't well off, but he wasn't broke. He wasn't a bad man, just kind and quiet. And although his wife had recently recovered from an overdose of sleeping pills, owing to Harry having uncovered her affair with a car dealer called George Jenkins, although they'd contemplated getting a divorce, they resolved it amicably. Harry Michelson was just an ordinary chap. So who would want to kill him? And why? Friday the 24th of December 1948. Christmas Eve. Across the city, with rationing still partially in force, a festive hum of excitement and frivolity rippled across this brightly lit city as the people shopped for presents. That day, from his post office savings account, Harry withdrew £3, roughly £130 today, to purchase a chicken and a piece of lamb, as well as £2 in silver so he could tip the porters over the holidays. The Christmas day itself was bright, but with no snow, a cold wind whistled down George Street. Being a man whose body swung from fevers to chills, owing to a distant bout of malaria, even though it was barely above freezing, for the last 7 years, he'd often left his thin bedroom window and his flat door ajar to help circulate the fresh air. But with a trusty team of porters always on duty, Harry felt safe. Rising at 8 a.m., the little flat hadn't got a single Christmas decoration up. As being Jewish, they didn't celebrate the holiday, so it didn't bother them in the slightest that they would spend it apart. At 9 a.m., hired to perform at a slew of hotels in the seaside town of Bournemouth until just after Boxing Day, Anna kissed Harry goodbye and headed off, not knowing that she would never see him again. For Harry, it was a simple day. Throughout the afternoon, he handed each of the porters several shillings as a thank you for their hard work, and said to one and all,
"Here's wishing you all the best."
He asked the head porter if he could pop the chicken and the lamb in their freezer, ready for his wife's return. And at 6 p.m, 8 p.m. and 10 p.m, he left via the main door, as having run out of bread, he had also forgotten that today was Christmas Day and that most of the bakers would be shut. At 10 p.m, he returned and was greeted by the night porters, Samuel Freeland and Frederick Newman, who said that, as usual, he was in a good mood, and although breadless, he wished them both well. As was his nightly routine, Harry undressed, putting his brown striped suit on the chair, his shoes by the bed, a glass of water by the bedside phone, and having finished a good book, in the single bed nearest the door, he drifted off to sleep, snoring loudly as the fresh winter air ventilated this usually stuffy flat. For the two porters, it was a busy night, as of the 300-plus tenants at Firstcroft, several Christmas parties ensured that a steady stream of guests entered and exited via both sets of main doors. Being routine, both were locked at midnight. Only the porters had the keys. Every guest or resident was only escorted in or out after that hour by the two night porters. And both doors were only unlocked at 7:30 a.m. Samuel and Frederick both confirmed that it was an uneventful night. Only for Harry, it was a night that, if he could, he would never forget. At 5:15 a.m, night porter Samuel Freeland heard a voice he recognized calling from downstairs. As Harry shouted, "Porter! Porter!
Porter!"
At the door of flat 75, dressed in just his pajamas and a bathrobe, the ghostly white frame of Harry stood, holding a towel to his head as a stream of blood ran down his panicked face. Samuel asked,
"What happened?"
At which Harry bluntly replied,
"Never mind. Call an ambulance. I'm bleeding like a pig."
Only what Samuel and possibly Harry didn't realize was that Harry already had. With the ambulance on its way, as the porters led Harry to the reception, stumbling and trembling, it was clear that he was afraid. And although he cried,
"I am dying. I can feel it in my bones and the blood pumping in my brain,"
it was clear that he had no idea what had happened. The porters assumed he'd had an accident, as nobody had heard a break-in, a scream, or an assault. Arriving at St. Mary's Hospital at 5:38 a.m. with a single wound to his right temple, which was no different to any other injury caused by a domestic slip or tumble. X-raying this 1.5-inch laceration, a fracture to the skull was identified, a blood clot was removed, and although initially conscious, Harry repeated,
"I can't tell you what happened. I don't know. I've not been in a fight, nor been drinking. All I know is that I discovered a lump on my head which is bleeding, and I know I won't live."
And although he didn't know much, he knew that. As drifting into a coma, the next day at 12:45 p.m, Harry died of his injuries, unable to tell the police anything about his accident. With the investigation headed up by Superintendent Beveridge, DDI Jameson, and Inspector Grange, Harry's flat didn't seem like the scene of an assault. Far from it. It was messy, but there were no signs of a struggle. With all three windows locked from within, there was no sign of forced entry. And with the blood dotted in a steady line upon the carpets between the bedroom, the bathroom, and the hallway, at some point, he'd grabbed a towel to stem the wound. He'd made a call for an ambulance, and then he'd collapsed upon his bed. If it was an attack, it was motiveless, as nothing seemed to be missing. His checkbook was on the sideboard. He'd got 16 shillings in his suit pockets, and several pieces of saleable artwork hadn't been touched. With no obvious weapon found, and only Harry's hair and blood identified, it didn't seem like a break-in by a stranger, so the police assumed that he'd let his assailant in. Several suspects were considered. Every guest at the Christmas parties in the block were questioned. And George Jenkinson, his wife's former lover, was quizzed. But all had cast iron alibis. With a wealth of sketches featuring unknown people who had posed for Harry found in his bedroom. Although it was assumed that he may have sketched his killer before the attack, this was proven to be unlikely. And even though two of the porters had criminal records, with one of them for violence, all eight were ruled out. The lack of evidence was driving the detectives towards a dangerous assumption:
that we believe he knew his killer.
And although
the theory that he'd been attacked by a walking thief has not been ruled out,
it didn't seem logical that a stranger would break in, steal nothing, and then leave as if he wasn't there. On closer examination, Anna later found that Harry's black leather wallet was missing and hidden by a steady stream of blood. On one of the legs of the metal tubular chair lay a finger and palm print which didn't belong to Harry, Anna, the police, or any of the porters. With the autopsy conducted by Dr. Donald Tier, identifying two crescent-shaped fractures to the right of his skull, one 5.5 inches long and the other 2.5 inches long, which were split into sharp shards which punctured his brain, it was confirmed that
the tubular steel chair was the most likely cause of his wounds.
This was no accident. But who had killed Harry? And why? The breakthrough in the investigation came down to an off-duty constable, unconnected to the case. On Tuesday, the 18th of January, 1949, PC Walsh spotted two men in dark clothes acting suspiciously in St. John's Wood, outside of two affluent houses on Grove End and Hamilton Terrace. And as the two men dipped between the shadows, slipped down dark alleys, and furtively peeped in through unlit windows, calling for backup, at 5:55 p.m., PC Walsh arrested 26-year-old Thomas Collier and 21-year-old Harry Lewis. With the details of every local burglar being passed to the murder squad, taking their fingerprints, police found a perfect match to the murder of Harry Michelson, which were linked to Harry Lewis. Questioned at Paddington Police Station, Harry Lewis swiftly confessed,
"I didn't think I would get away with it. When I read about it in the newspapers, I knew he was the man I hit."
But who was Harry Lewis? And why had he murdered Harry Michelson? Born 28 years before, and 170 miles northwest of Harry Michelson's birthplace, Harry Lewis was the illegitimate son of Annie Lewis, a single mother. Unable to support herself, being admitted to the Poor Law Institution at Howarden in northeast Wales. Aged 3, Harry Lewis was abandoned, and for the rest of his childhood, he would be bounced from foster parents to orphanages and to penal institutions. From ages 3 to 9, he spent in the dark, depressing gloom of the Cottage Homes Orphanage in Holywell, where a lack of love left him feeling abandoned, lost, and angry at the world. For 1 year, he was briefly boarded out to Mrs. Williams in Leeswood, and although she said he was likeable and well-behaved, growing sicker, he was sent back to the orphanage, where he would spend 9 years. Age 12, with the Second World War having erupted, against his will, he was sent to the nautical training school in Portishead, where destitute and neglected boys were given hard military discipline. Subjected to 4 years of compulsory discipline, his report described him as unsatisfactory, with numerous instances of dishonesty and theft. He is a boy greatly lacking in decent moral principles. Booted out of the Naval Training School and being bounced back into the public institution at Holywell, his file lists him as troublesome, insolent, unmanageable, and a confirmed thief. And lasting just a few weeks as a labourer at the steelworks in Shotton, Harry was seen as a poor workman and mentally weak. What followed was a series of committals to institutions and petty criminal acts. In December 1943, aged 16, he was placed on probation back at the Holywell Public Institution, where he absconded. In January 1944, he was sentenced to 28 days for stealing cigarettes. The next month, he was committed to 2 years at the approved probation home for youths in Stonebridge Park. And although only aged 17, having enlisted as a private in the Middlesex Regiment to avoid any more time in Borstal, he was fined £7 in Chester for forgery, sentenced to 2 years at Marylebone for theft, and discharged for theft and assaulting a woman. That had been his entire life, up until the age of 20. on the 7th of December 1948, just 18 days before the murder. Harry Lewis was released from Wormwood Scrubs prison. Described as a violent and undisciplined man, whose record reveals no redeeming features. Even though he was married and had a three-year-old child, he didn't have a job. He didn't have a home. His wife had rightfully fled from her violent and abusive husband. And he had nothing. Abandoned, just like he had been as a baby, he drifted across the city with no money, no hope, no life, and no future. By the Christmas day of 1948, Harry Lewis had never met Harry Michelson. He didn't know him. He was a stranger. It's a strange thought, but while the city celebrated Christmas, both Harrys were sat alone. With Harry Michelson in his basement flat in Marylebone, and Harry Lewis in a cheap B&B in Euston. And whereas one made his living by bringing joy to the masses with his sketches, the other knew nothing but theft.
"It was early on Sunday morning,"
Harry Lewis said.
"I'd no money and thought I'd break into a house and get some."
It was between 2 a.m. and 3 a.m. when passing the corner of Brown Street and Nutford Place that Harry Lewis happened to stumble upon a thin casement window left open a crack by a man whose dose of malaria 30 years before had left his body swinging from fevers to chills, even on a cold night like this.
"There was a big drop down into the basement, so I jumped the railings and dropped."
Far from the porter's view. Hidden in the dark, as the convicted burglar crept along the concrete slit,
"I opened the window and heard a man snoring.
Breaking into a dark but occupied flat was riddled with risks, like injury, capture, arrest, and even death. But being desperate, it was worth the risk, just as long as Harry Lewis was silent.
"I climbed in. It was dark. I was feeling my way around, and I came to the bottom of a bed at the far end."
That being Harry's bed.
"A man's trousers was lying on the metal chair. I took a wallet, some coins, and then I went into the hall."
As a stranger, staggering about in this unfamiliar flat, he had no idea that the hall only led to the kitchen cum bathroom, the corridors of Firstcroft, which were paroled by the night porters, a set of main doors which had been locked many hours before, and that the only item of any real value which was worth stealing was the wallet. Harry didn't know that. But by then, his luck had run out.
"When I got into the hall, a chap sat up in bed and said, 'Who's there?
Who's there?'"
With the owner awake, the only way out was through him and the window from which he had entered.
"The chap was just getting out of bed. I was frightened of getting caught. So I picked up the metal chair. It was the first thing I could put my hands on. And I thought I could knock him out with it. Just a bash on the head. He fell, but started getting up again. So I swung the chair again and gave him another bash. I then dropped the chair and left the way I came in.
Fleeing into the cold night and hopping into a taxi on Edgware Road, the burglar of 75 Firstcroft got away with 4 £1 notes and 2 10-shilling notes. Barely enough to last him until the end of the week. It was a random attack by a total stranger for the sake of some quick cash. Harry Michelson was small and sick, so there was unlikely to be a struggle. And with the attack swift, very little to steal, and no obvious points of entry or exit, the detectives had made a lazy assumption based on the evidence they had. But it was wrong. And they wouldn't realise the truth until Harry Lewis made a full confession. Back in the flat, slumped on the bed, as blood poured down his head, the detectives wouldn't suspect that the thin casement window was how the burglar had got in. As in doing what anyone else would have done, being attacked in their own home, Harry Michelson had locked it and drew the curtain. It's tragic, but Harry could have survived his attack. Only being helpless and alone, with his wife many miles south, the porters above, and his neighbours asleep having heard nothing. Stumbling about his lonely flat, with no memory of what had happened. The sharp shards of his fractured skull dug deep into his brain, leaving him confused, bleeding, and afraid. It's likely he'd spent at least 2 hours, maybe 3, either collapsed on his bed, or wandering about, unsure why his head was bleeding. But having momentarily gained a short sense of consciousness, he phoned for an ambulance at 5:12 a.m. and called the porter just 3 minutes after that.
Porter! Porter!
33 hours later, Harry Michelson was dead. Tried at the Old Bailey on the 9th of March 1949, before Lord Chief Justice Goddard, Harry Lewis pleaded not guilty to the murder of Harry Michelson. He didn't deny the burglary or the attack, stating,
"I saw in the newspapers a photo of the window I'd got through, and I realised the man I'd hit was dead. I did not know the dead man. It was just a chance shot that I entered that place that night. And although I hit him hard, I didn't mean to kill him. I did it just to get away without being caught."
That same day, although one of the jury had to be expelled as they objected to the death penalty, a jury of 10 men and women deliberated for 35 minutes and unanimously found him guilty of murder. Sympathising with his tragic upbringing, the jury recommended mercy for Harry Lewis. But with his appeal dismissed on the 21st of April, he was executed by hanging that very same day. Harry Michelson was buried in East Ham Jewish Cemetery, and Harry Lewis was buried in Pentonville Prison. That said, the murder of Harry Michelson might never have been solved had the detectives not been so dogged as to assume he'd let his killer in. As Eugene Fordsworth said, assumption is the mother of all mistakes. And by making a simple assumption, they had made the mother of all mistakes. And although there was a small chance that as he lay in his hospital bed, that one minute Michelson could sketch his killer as the detectives hoped, by that point, that's all his memory was. Sketches.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com. A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Oh, there we go. Oh, it's a bit of a race to get that done. Bloody, oh, the... I was looking at the weather and thinking, oh, the weather said it was going to piss down at 11 o'clock, and this is not quite 10, it's 8:45 in the morning. And I looked at it, the weather report this morning, and it said it's fine, it's not going to rain, there's just going to be a little bit of drizzle about 11 o'clock, maybe 2, yeah? Pissing down at 9:30, absolutely pissing down. Thank you, Met Office. So, yeah, so I was racing to get that done at the end, and then whenever the rain happens, the great thing with the rain is it stops the little annoying little aircraft that go by, and it stops the annoying barky dogs that are shouting at each other. But it doesn't shut up Coot and Moorhen, who go, oh, I need to shout because it's raining. So, anyway, you take your little hat off. There we go. Hat off. Welcome to Extra Mile. Unscripted. This is the unscripted, unedited bit, which comes at the end. We do a little chat. I make a cup of coffee. I used to make tea, but now I'm kind of on a diet. I'm trying to stay off milk and sugar and things like that. Even though I still have sugar here, I occasionally have one. And sometimes I put in my powdered milk in there. But it just goes clumpy now. It's horrible shit. I'm so used to black coffee now. I may end up being the black coffee king of black coffee, and then when I go to Costa later on, I'll have my decaf soya latte. There we go, like a twat. So yeah, we have a chat. We do some questions, kind of quiz questions about this episode, and then I'll fill you in on some details that wouldn't have made it into the episode. And don't forget, if you enjoy Extra Mile, if you become a patron supporter, and if you are the tier that's Handsome Hamlet and above, you get Walk With Me. And that's after I've finished editing this. I literally put the microphone on, and then I go walking somewhere, normally to the coffee shop or sometimes to put my bins out. Exciting stuff, that, because my life is wonderful, isn't it? Shit like that. And then I fill you in on all the details of the things that never made it into the episode and kind of theories that I have and things like that. So, and also little secrets about things that I've added into the episode that no one else will know. So you can do that via being a patron supporter. Also, you get loads of extra goodies as well. Let me go and put my... kettle on. Oh, ow. Oh, there we go. Open the window, let some air in. Yeah, bit drizzly, but there we go. I'm going to open up, I'm going to open the window behind me as well. Probably no one will come past now, which is fine, because it's Yeah, it's not raining, but it's drizzly. So people will go, oh, I don't want to go out. So what's going on? Still on my diet, which is good. Still sticking to that. Only I'm at that point now where I think everything's going in reverse. I think my body is just used to crap, good food and no crap. And therefore, like I do, like I do like 20,000, 25,000 steps a day. And my exercise in the morning, and I eat well, and you know, things like that. And I don't have crap in my diet, or I have a little bit of crap every so often just to help out. But I think I'm going in reverse. I think my body's going, yeah, you can have a carrot, but then I'll make you put on weight for having a carrot, bastard. So there it is. I was hoping to get through this episode. There's lots of a year's supply of tissues next to me because I think I'm getting a cold. I think it's the start of that season where I'm getting a cold. So I was racing forward to try and... I was like, oh no, I'm getting a cold. Worst thing you want to do is do an episode when you get a cold. But I think I did a while. I got through it. And this is one of my first days of having both eyes working. This is great. This is great news. So after... for those who don't know, I had 6 weeks of bronchitis. I ruptured... 6 weeks of bronchitis, when that got over, I got a week of conjunctivitis, and not realising that my eye was ruptured, the conjunctivitis went into the eye, and then it started getting really bad, and it was bulging out of the eye because of all the pressure. It was really horrible, and I almost went blind in that eye. My vision went close to blind, which was horrible because I don't have great vision anyway, but luckily I'm a patient at a well-known eye hospital, and they've been amazing. They've been really good. So I've been in and out practically every week to 2 weeks for the last couple of months on some really serious heavy drugs in my eyes and checking it out. And the other day they were in there, they were like, great, the scar has healed. You can barely tell there's a wound anymore. We don't need to do an operation. That all looks good. Let's put your lens back in and see if there's any change. And there hasn't been a change in my eye. It seems all right. It hasn't got... They said it could get better. It could get worse. It's most likely to get worse. But nothing has happened. So I think I got really lucky with this one. So I've both lenses in today, which is great. So I can now... It's weird being able to see everything again. Because I've had no depth perception for a long time. So not able to see things with both eyes, like just using one eye. So now it's really weird. Now I'm having to rework out how to pick things up. Because when you've only got one eye, you kind of learn a new way of depth perception. You learn to kind of scoot around things and then pick things up. But now, because I can see, now I'm having to work out how to pick things up again. It's really weird. Anyway, that's how exciting my life is. Thank you to two new Patreon supporters, Celia Miller and Amanda Miller. Not related, I don't think, because they live in different countries. I'm not going to say which countries, because that's your private thing. But thank you, Celia, and thank you, Amanda, for becoming Patreon supporters. Your goodies are in the post. Celia, I know you've already got yours, because you just messaged me to say you got them. Hang on. Oh, give me kettle. There we go. Normally I say I'm making a cuppa, and I probably won't... I probably won't drink it, because normally at this point I go off to the coffee shop, or as my grandma used to say, coffee shop. Normally I go to the coffee shop, but it's a pissy down day. It's still early. I've still got, how much power have I got in my battery? 70%. So I've got, it says 7 hours. We know that's not 7 hours. We know it's going to be. That'll take me through to about 1 o'clock, I think. And then I think I'll go up to the coffee shop and do some more editing there. So I think I'm going to drink that coffee, have my big fat carrot. That's my treat during the day, is eating carrots during the day. Oh, my life is exciting. And then occasionally in the evening, I might treat myself to a rice cracker. Michael, your life is just wow. Whoa. Can life get any better? Oh, thank you to Please Constable Arsenal Guinness to the Metropolitan Plotter. It was lovely to catch up with Please Constable Arsenal Guinness the other night. And we went out, we started with the Guinness. Yes, he's doing very well. It was lovely to see him. I haven't seen him since, God, I think it was February. Yeah, it was around the time of my birthday. We had a good chat about New Blue. So we're going to book in some time to do some New Blue. So they'll be coming out soon. But it's lovely to see him again. We got very pissed. We found some very nice beers. We got very drunk. And then I filmed a little video while drunk on the street, which I posted on my social media, which I shouldn't have done, but I thought, bollocks, I'm drunk. I don't care. I just wanted to work out what it was like to be Eva. Obviously, she's not that drunk. She's kind of 20 times worse than that, but I want to experience her life. Let's do some quiz questions. It's really pissing down now. That's it. You may not think it's a bad thing, like it raining, but because this is a steel boat that I'm in, like when it rains, when it hits the roof, it really echoes and it reverberates around the whole boat. So sometimes it could be absolutely deafening if the rail is really hard. So I need to be really careful. Let's do some quiz questions. I'll focus these quiz questions mostly on Harry Michelson, and then we'll dive into some extra stuff, mostly about Harry Lewis, because we kind of jumped through him. Not literally. So, question number one. In what decade was Firscroft, which is where Harry Michelson's flat was, in what decade was Firscroft built? Question number two. What did Anna, his wife, do as a job? Question number three. The window in Harry's bedroom overlooked which two roads? Question number four, where did Harry go for his morning coffee? Question number five, what club was Harry a member of? Question number six, what food did Harry buy for his wife's return? Question number seven, in what town was Anna performing in? Question number eight, what had Harry ran out of that day? Not ran out of as in ran out of, like what object items had he run out of? Question number nine, what was the name of the burglar? Hang on, what was the name of the burglar? Oh, yes, sorry. I thought I'd literally written a question that you could have answered easily. Question number nine, what was the name of the burglar who Harry Lewis was arrested with? And question number 10, where in London was Harry Lewis arrested? Right, so let's make sure. Don't forget, I haven't edited this episode yet, so I might balls up some of these questions. If they do, don't worry about it. You can get that for free. You can have a free answer. So let's dive into Harry Lewis. He was living at that point at 6 Melton Street in Euston. Front bedroom on the third floor. It was a B&B. So he'd literally just come out of Wormwood Scrubs prison, which is over in West London, and now he was in Euston in a B&B trying to find somewhere to live. He was born 6th of July 1927 in and around Chester, but we don't know exactly where. His mum, Annie Lewis, originally she lived in Parsons Green in London in 1926, so just before she was... It looked like she was a chambermaid or someone who was in service of a lady called Mrs. Burkett in Sydenham. It seems like she got pregnant around that time. 8th of July 1930, she was admitted to the Poor Law Institution in Hawarden in Flintshire. That's North East Wales. So you're kind of on the border of Cheshire and Liverpool. So you're kind of that area up there. It's kind of quite sad because in all the records here, Harry Lewis, even though he's only 3 years old, he's classified as an inmate. Because this is a poor law institution, and because she's deemed as kind of, she's a single mum, she's got a child. It's classified as a really, really bad thing for her to do. How dare she, have sex, even though it might not have been her choice. And then she ends up pregnant and dumped and alone. So they were both basically an inmate of poverty. So ended up at Cottage House, which is still there today. It's I believe it's called Clusty Hospital in Hollywell in Flintshire. So that used to be the Cottage Home Orphanage. 13th of October 1930, his mother was discharged at her own request, but being unable to look after him, she gave him up at that point, and his mother's whereabouts are not known. We don't know anything about her after that point. I've done a search, can't find anything about her. She basically just disappeared. 17th of October 1930, he was transferred from there to the Cottage's home in Hollywell. Same building, but adopted by the Public Assistance Committee under Section 52 of the Poor Law Act 1930, and kept in the orphanage until 1936. So that's 6 years in an orphanage at all. You know, not probably not a great place to be, not really a good sense of love. Also, age three, he's just at that age where obviously he'll remember his mum, but he'll be asking the questions, where is she? Why is she gone? He's of an age where he can process things like that. 21st of February 1936, he was boarded out to a Mrs. Williams on Albert Street in Leeswood, Flintshire. He was 9 years old. He attended the Leeswood County School while he was with her. She said he was healthy, likeable and well-behaved. But he had to be returned to Cottage Homes Orphanage when he became ill. So for 1 year, when he was 9 years old, he had a sense of normality. Resent back to Cottage Homes. They really didn't define what his sickness was at that point. We just don't know. Nothing is written there. So in total, after two more years there, he'd spent a total of 9 years in the orphanage. 3rd of February 1939, so war has just broken out. He's 12 years old. He's placed in the nautical training school in Portishead in Somerset, and there for a total of 4 years. So the National Nautical School in Portishead was a school built in 1869 for destitute and neglecting young boys, initially of Bristol, but they kind of welcomed other people in. Originally, it was based on a former military ship called the HMS Formidable, which was moored just offshore. It was like that for about 40, 45 years. And what they did was as we've seen in the, if you go back to the episode like Silly Little Boys, you'll see that we're in an era there where what they believe in, you shouldn't be kind to these young ruffians. What you should do is you should treat them, you should shout at them, you should bark at them, you should instill, you should instill kind. Oh, I'm just turning my light off. You shouldn't instill with them that you need to turn your light off. But you should. Their kind of thing is you instill into them discipline by shouting at them. And as we know, that doesn't work. If you come from an institution where you haven't had any love, going to another place where you get zero love and all you get is barked at, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. But that was the attitude back then. That's what you need to do was, you know, for some people it does work, you know, routine and things like that. But for other people, it just doesn't work at all. So there, pupils were taught seamanship and other relevant skills such as shoemaking, tailoring and carpentry. The school had also a military band, and over 50 years, 3,500 boys were discharged from there. From the school, many went into the Royal Navy, although a larger proportion, actually the majority of them, ended up in the Merchant Navy, which is kind of the commercial side of... They do a lot of the shipping, so when war was going on, they would do, like, moving supplies around and things like that. While he was there, described as most unsatisfactory, and there were numerous instances of dishonesty and theft, and he has continued disobedience to the school rules. He was a boy who seemed to be greatly lacking in any decent moral principles. Again, while he was there, he's only 16 years old. August 1943, he returned to the public institution at Holywell in Flintshire, having been withdrawn by the authority. And later, under supervision with the institution, he was found to be troublesome, insolent, unmanageable, and a confirmed thief. He did manage to get a little bit of work as a labourer at John Sumner's and Sons Steelworks in Shotton, Flintshire. But Mr. Grigson Rogers, who was the shift manager, said he was a poor workman and mentally weak. So he's getting to that point now where he's out of the orphanages. He's aged out. He's 16 and beyond, so he's aged out. He's kind of done a little bit of military service, but he's not really doing too well there. And now he's kind of building up a bit of a criminal record because he's got nowhere to go. He's got nothing to do. He's bored. He's angry at the world. 18th of December 1943, age 16, at Northrop Police Court. He got probation for 2 years for larceny and was brought back to the Holywell Public Institution, which was where he was born, where he was raised. He absconded from there and went to Liverpool. 5th of January 1944, again age 16, he was brought back, charged with stealing cigarettes from a dwelling house,
and whilst on remand in Liverpool for 28 days, he was sent... he was submitted for an assessment at Liverpool Psychiatric Clinic. Now, I didn't put this in the episode because we'd already kind of covered what people thought of him, but it says, while on remand at Liverpool, Dr. Muriel Hall, the psychiatrist at Liverpool Clinic, said, the boy was of average intelligence, but extremely weak in character development. He knows the difference between right and wrong, but has very little sense of responsibility with regard to the property of others. Age 17, he has failed to benefit from nearly 4 years of discipline and training. He is normally intelligent and pleasant in nature. So, after that, age 17, February 1944, he was bound over and fined £5, which is... I always find it ironic when they, you know, someone's got no money and they're breaking into places, but they are fined an amount of money. And you just go, well, where are they going to get the money from, you dickhead? It's just that kind of thing. I know it's box ticking in the terms of law, and you've got to go, well, we've got to do it because that is the law. But it's like, if someone can't afford it, why force them to pay? So £5 is that's about £200. That's quite a lot of money, especially for a young lad who's 17 years old and doesn't have a home and doesn't have an income. He was put on probation there, but on the condition that he resided at the approved probation house for youths at Stanley House in Stonebridge Park, which is northwest London. And there he was employed as a cleaner. So he's gone from Flintshire, and then they moved him down to London. Doesn't make any sense at all. 7th of February 1945, again age 17, he enlisted as a private in the Middlesex Regiment. But just a couple of months later, he was fined £7 for obtaining £3 off the Postmaster General for forgery. That doesn't mean he robbed the Postmaster General himself. That just means against the postal system. 13th of November 1945, age 18, at Marylebone. So he's down here. Sentenced to 2 years and 2 months for stealing cash and receiving coupons for clothing books. He was discharged from prison and returned to the army, but on the 12th of June 1946, a field court-martial was convened and he was sentenced to 120 days for larceny. Almost immediately upon release from that, a second field court-martial was convened and he was sentenced to 12 months in prison for assaulting, occasioning GBH. There's few details about that, but apparently he assaulted a woman. We don't know anything more about that. I did search. Being discharged from the army, he was then transferred to HMP Wormwood Scrubs Prison, which we've covered before, to complete his sentence. They said his character was very bad, a violent and undisciplined man whose record reveals no redeeming features. And he had a definite grudge against society. He did briefly do a little bit of work as a machinist at George Kemp & Co., a biscuit manufacturer's on the North Circular Road, but he was only there barely a week. Again, another charge just after that in Chester City. So he was moving around a lot, and which was for larceny of cash and attempted forgery. He married 27th of March 1946 to a lady called Kathleen Mary. She lived in Chester, so that seems to be the reason why he's going back and forth from London to Chester a lot, so he can see his wife. He had not provided a home for her or the family. They'd also got a young daughter, and the only money she received was from his army allowance, which ended when he was discharged. She last saw him in August 1948, so about 4 or 5 months before the murder, and isn't interested in fixing the marriage. Apparently he was quite a nasty, violent man. Prior to the murder, so we know Mrs. Dixon, the landlady at 6 Melton Street, said that day, so Christmas morning, he left at 2:17 p.m. He was wearing a brown suit and returned at 7 a.m. the next day, which is Boxing Day, so couple of hours after the murder. When asked where he had been, he said to an Irish dance, but revealed nothing of nothing else that was relevant. Police did actually, when he was arrested, police did actually go to his room, but there was nothing in there, nothing of relevance in there. By this point, he would have moved on and it would have been lent out to someone else anyway. The missing hours, kind of quite sad that you've got Harry Michelson, that he's been bashed over the head, and we don't know when it happened. Harry Lewis, the burglar, said it was sometime between 2 and 3, but he doesn't have an exact time because no one heard a scream or anything like that. We can't pin it down. So it's roughly between 2 and 3. But we know that around that time, he was wandering around. He'd been hit over the head. So he's obviously concussed. He's wandering around the flat in a semi-conscious state. We know where he'd been because there were kind of regular splashes of blood between the bathroom and the bedroom and the hallway. He doesn't seem to have gone out of the flat. It doesn't seem to have coagulated. One of the porters, I think it was Samuel Freeland, said there wasn't any kind of matting in the hair or kind of there was no clumps of blood. It was just constantly free flowing. And even when he saw him at 5:15, so even at the earliest, that's 2 hours that his head had been bleeding. It's still free flowing. So he's obviously because he's fractured his because his skull has been fractured and the sharp edges of the bones are kind of embedding into his skull. Obviously, he's got a real brain hemorrhage going on there, and he's bleeding quite a lot. So we can see where he's been. We know that he collapsed on his bed for a while. We don't know how long. We know he went to his bathroom and picked up a towel to kind of stem the flow, but we don't know anything about that point. Charles Hall of the Paddington Telephone Exchange stated that at 5 a.m. On Boxing Day, he took a call, asked what the number was, and the man replied it was Paddington 2838, which was the phone in Harry's flat next to his bed. So we're assuming that Harry made the call. It's more than likely it is, because they were able to track down the taxi driver, and the taxi driver had said that Harry Lewis was picked up on Edgware Road, and he took him to the Lion's Cornhouse Tea Room on Coventry Street, just off Piccadilly Circus. When Harry was in the car, he opened up the wallet, he pulled out the 4 £1 notes, and I think it was two 10 shilling notes, and he stuffed the wallet down the side of the taxi. So it was eventually found, but that wasn't until a lot later. So the ambulance driver, so this is in the era where obviously you've got to call the telephone exchange, and then the telephone exchange will connect you to who you need to get in touch with. So that was connected to the ambulance service at 5:06 a.m. The man said, send an ambulance to flat 75 George Street. I'm hemorrhaging badly. The ambulance service said that they received Samuel Freeland, who was the night porter, received his call at 5:12 a.m. So that was just 6 minutes later. So it does appear that Harry Michelson probably hit over the head, probably wandered around a bit, probably collapsed onto his bed, was probably there for about 2 hours, maybe a bit longer, regained consciousness about 5 a.m. and that's when he made the call. What else do we need? Let's have a look. I think that's most of it. Harry Michelson was quite terrified. I think it's clear that people said. They said he was unusually loud and shouting quite a lot, which was really unlike him because he's quite a quiet man. He had a towel to his head, blood running down his face, and was dressed in his pyjamas and dressing gown. Samuel Freeland said, what happened? Harry said, never mind. Get me help at once. Phone Middlesex Hospital. I'm bleeding like a pig. Where was the other bit? Yeah, they said he was hysterically shouting, which is unusual for him because he's normally quite calm. There was another quote that I wanted to get. When they got him in the main hallway in reception, waiting for the ambulance to turn up, Harry said, I know I'm going to die. My poor wife. I shall die before I see her. Will you get in touch with her? Freeland asked how he'd got his injuries, and Harry said, I can't tell you. I don't know. I'm a dying man. I know I'm going to die. Look, I'm covered in blood. It was actually the ambulance man who was there, even though the porters, it's not their job to kind of medically assess people, and they're not trained. But even though the ambulance men at that point were really just ambulance drivers with a little bit of kind of medical training, but not like proper paramedics like we have now. These are just people who kind of assess you quickly and then get you to the hospital as quick as possible. The driver, William Holly, arrived at 5:23 a.m., saw two porters in the hall, and that Harry was losing a lot of blood to the right temple, and he quickly dressed the room, dressed the wound, and drove him to St Mary's Hospital in Paddington, arriving at 5:38 a.m. It was actually the ambulance driver who looked at him and made the decision to alert the police that he thought there'd been an assault. And he, obviously he was right at that point. So the police didn't know anything about it at that point, and may not have known anything about it because it could, if it had been reported that it could have been just an accident, it could have been brushed off as an accident. So that could have been another assumption. There you go. You're welcome. I think that's it. The police, the doctors were able to communicate with Harry a little bit, but not much while he was in hospital. He kept drifting in and out of consciousness and kept repeating it a lot. What the police wanted to do was, because he was a sketch artist, they were hoping he would be conscious enough that they could, like, Inspector Grange would go in with a notepad and, like, hoped that they could put it in front of him and say, sketch the guy who kind of, who attacked you. But obviously he couldn't remember that. His short-term memory was entirely gone. He could remember the fact that his wife was in Bournemouth. He could remember what day it was, things like that. He just couldn't remember what had happened. So I think that's it. I think that's all I really wanted to add about that. Pretty much everything else is in the episode. Autopsy by Dr. Donald Tear. There was a crescent wound 5.5 inches long from the right ear to the right eyebrow. Another crescent shaped wound 2.5 inches long, branching off from the initial wound. Initially, it was hard to tell what wounds he got to his head, because when he was in hospital, because they found a bleed and impacted wounds, he was operated upon. So therefore, his scalp was shaved and a drainage tube was added. But they also found a 1.5 inch long, 1/4 inch wide wound over the right shoulder blade. So that would have come also from the tubular chair. And his second and third ribs were broken from the spine, with the second rib piercing the back, the lining of the back. Again, this would be from the chair as well. Cause of death was due to depressed fractures of the skull. He was identified by David Michelson, who was his younger brother, who was mentioned earlier in the episode. So another story of someone being attacked in their bed. Oh, great. Oh, great. Happy days. Sleep well, everyone. Sleep well. So let's do some quiz questions. I hope I haven't ballsed up. No, I didn't. I don't think I ballsed up any. Okay. Question number one, in what decade was Firscroft built? It's the 1930s. Question number two, what did Anna, his wife, do as a job? Oh, she was a pianist. Oh. Question number three, the window in Harry's bedroom overlooked which two roads? It was Brown Street and Nutford Place. Question number four, where did Harry go for his morning coffee? It was Maison Lyonnaise, which is at the Cumberland Hotel just off Marble Arch. And that is where the Black Eyed Ripper met his first victim, possibly. Question number five. What club was Harry a member of? It was the Sketch Club. Question number six. What food did Harry buy for his wife's return? It was a chicken and a piece of lamb. Question number seven. What town was Anna performing in? It was Bournemouth. Question number eight, what had Harry run out of that day? It was bread. Question number nine, what was the name of the burglar that Harry Lewis was arrested with? It was Thomas Collier. And question number 10, where in London was Harry Lewis arrested? It was St John's Wood. So there you go, folks. There you go. Oh, I need a wee wee now. Really need a wee wee. You needed to know that, didn't you? So that's it done, folks. Hope you enjoyed that. We've got two more single parters to go, then a three parter to take us into Christmas, and then if I can get time to meet up with Postcultural Hustle Guinness and the Metropolitan Blood, we will do some new blues probably for the new year, and I might do some stuff over Christmas. I haven't decided yet. So thank you for supporting the show, everyone. Hope you're all well. Stay safe. Be good. And that's it. I think that's it. Yeah, that's me done. Cool. Lovely. I'm going to finish my coffee and have a pee-pee. Have yourself a good week, folks. Stay safe. Lots of love. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.